I'm Edith Vale.
And I'm Maureen McGillicuddy.
And we host Another Cuppa.
It's a darling little program where we natter away with some of Australia's biggest names.
Like Poling Yao. Now, would you like a cuppa?
I would love a cuppa.
How do you take it, love?
As often as possible.
I wish.
Watch Another Cuppa on ABC iView, YouTube, or listen on ABC Listen.
Hooroo.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just to let you know before we start, this episode contains references to sexual violence and disordered eating.
Autism is so many things. It is not a stereotype, and it is not a look.
If you're Australian or have spent any time here, you know Grace Tame. She's the 2021 Australian of the Year, a fearless human rights campaigner, athlete and public speaker who fights for victims of childhood sexual abuse. She loves animals, the outdoors and op shopping. She's a keen long-distance runner, cyclist, horse rider and suffers absolutely no fools. But there's a side of Grace the public doesn't know so well. As a kid, Grace often felt different from the people around her. She struggled with sensory overload, understanding social cues, and she hated change.
I was bullied for being quirky and, you know, I would have these sort of very intense special interests.
For years, Grace was misdiagnosed and misunderstood before finally getting an autism diagnosis in her late teens. The diagnosis was a profound reframing of who she is and who she was. And because she's Grace Tame, she wants change. Not just for herself, but for every woman who's been missed and every autistic girl coming next. I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about being autistic with Grace Tame.
I remember she handed me a picture book called All Cats Have Asperger's.
When Grace was 19, she was sitting in her psychologist's office as she'd done many times before.
And on each page is a picture of a cat doing something cat-like, and on the corresponding page is a description of an autistic trait that is also similar.
On the pages were things like autistic people get worried if their schedules change, or autistic people have exceptionally good hearing, but loud noises might scare them. This book was Grace's psychologist's way of gently broaching that she thought she might be autistic.
I got to the end of the book and I was sobbing. I was distraught. I was sitting there thinking, well, either I'm autistic or I'm a cat. And it turns out, believe it or not, not a cat.
Not a cat.
At this
what
stage.
A bombshell, Grace Tame. What a freaking bombshell.
You're
not a cat, but you are autistic. So the book helped you see it.
Yes, the book really put it into clear focus for me.
You've been called all sorts of things throughout your life: sensitive, divisive, non-compliant, and you were called difficult by none other than our Prime Minister.
I thought you were just listing things that my dad says about me.
Can we talk about something that you do identify with? What were the earliest signs or stories from your family that made you think, oh yeah, of course, that's autism?
Mum describes me as being a very placid but active baby, but I was really distressed whenever she took me to a public bathroom and the hand dryer went off. Now, that's a common experience for autistic people.
A lot of noises and sensations that are background or unnoticed by other people are turned up full blast for Grace. We're talking air conditioners, fluorescent lights, hair dryers, and even fridges.
So that was probably one of the earliest signs, was my hypersensitivity to those sorts of sounds. When I was about 3, Mum suspected that I was deaf, so she took me to get my hearing tested. It turns out that I'm not deaf. I have trouble filtering out background noise. So I have what's called auditory processing disorder.
Just to stay in your childhood for a little longer, what did people misunderstand about you the most when you were a kid?
I was always described as weird and quirky. I survived socially in many ways because I had a sense of humor, you know, and was somewhat of a class clown. I would have these sort of very intense special interests, one of which was the comedy of Robin Williams. And I would be able to, because I have this ability to retain large swathes of information that aren't necessarily useful. and I have to be careful that I don't sort of push out, you know, like family birthdays and things like that. But I would be able to quote, just like rattle off whole monologues, you know, like the opening monologue from Good Morning Vietnam that Robin Williams famously delivered.
Yeah.
You know, I can still rattle that off if pressed as a sort of party trick.
Right. I can only remember, good morning, Vietnam.
Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMC. Is that me? Or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, Da Nang me. Oh, I could keep going.
Wow.
I'm not going to. It goes for like 2 minutes.
Yeah, amazing. Okay. We don't need that.
Yeah, we don't need that.
But I was also curious about like being mistaken for she's so dramatic or she's so sensitive or needy.
I mean, I certainly was, I think, called dramatic, but not necessarily by people who were particularly supportive. I do remember as a child, though, when I was 3 or 4, being told that I, you know, aside from being regularly told that I needed to make eye contact with people, I was told that I needed to be a more active participant in conversation.
In primary school, Grace covered up missing these social cues by overextending herself. She pushed herself to get top marks, ran cross country, performed in school plays, and was the only girl on the soccer team. But it was a real struggle when she went from the comfort of her very familiar local school to a stitched-up all-girls high school where the social dynamics and expectations were completely different.
That dramatic change really dysregulated me. I didn't respond well to it at all.
During this stressful time, Grace's sensitivities around food intensified and she restricted what she ate. Later, she would learn it was ARFID, A-R-F-I-D, which is Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder, a common condition in the autistic community where people can feel really overwhelmed by the texture, smell, colour or taste of food.
And that's something that I really struggled with but was misdiagnosed as being anorexic at age 14. And it was in treatment for anorexia that my mum raised with the medical team the idea that I was actually autistic and that was something that needed to be addressed. And she was dismissed by the doctors. And it wasn't until I was 19 years old that I received a clinical autism diagnosis.
Sadly, this is a common story. A lot of autistic women and girls get dismissed and misdiagnosed, often as having eating disorders, borderline personality disorder, or bipolar instead. Typically, girls don't get diagnosed until much later compared to boys, who tend to be diagnosed between the ages of 1 and 4. Grace has some theories about why she was missed as a kid.
I think because I was so sensitive to the needs of others, especially given the fact that I had to be sensitive to sort of constantly changing needs as I was moving between two different households that had different needs, I learned that the safest way to survive was to make sure that I was pleasing the others in the environment that I was in and adhering to that environment as opposed to asserting my own needs, which really it took a long time for me to identify because I had suppressed them so much.
Do you think about that time with regret?
It's hard to say, you know, if we reflect on our life and change certain things, what else then would change as a response? And I'm lucky in many ways in that I've always been surrounded by close, supportive, accepting, tolerant family and friends. And in fact, my best friend to this day, his name is Dom. We met when we were 7 years old in primary school. He's also autistic. And our friendship has been, pardon the pun, somewhat of a saving grace.
How did your parents respond to your autism diagnosis?
My mother was very supportive and has always been a really staunch advocate for me and my needs. And she had done a lot of research. She had books that she provided me with that are sort of my Bibles to this day that have really helped me to sort of not only understand myself, but understand how I can best interact with a predominantly neurotypical world.
Yep.
My dad was at first quite resistant, which is quite funny considering that in the last sort of, I don't know, third of his 35-year public high school teaching career, he worked solely with higher needs kids, including kids who had autism. And if you go to my dad's house, it's a living, breathing autism diagnosis.
Is it really? What does that look like?
It looks like everything organized according to the color spectrum.
Wow.
And a prohibitive standard of hygiene and cleanliness.
Like that, yep.
He is a stickler for routine. Yeah.
So and your dad's autistic.
The sky's blue. You know what I mean? Don't know what else to tell you.
So Grace and her dad share a few autistic traits, but it's Grace's mum who has been her biggest supporter.
I literally wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for my mum. She, to this day, is not in stature, but certainly in spirit, my biggest advocate. And thinking about what she has sacrificed in order to protect me and give me the best life and to make sure that I felt loved. I mean, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky.
What did she sacrifice?
Oh, just her own time and needs. And I know that's part of parenthood. I haven't had the privilege yet of raising a child. I hope to one day. And if I could be even a sliver of the force of love and light that my mum is, I'd be very happy.
Grace has always felt like she can be exactly who she is around her mum. But that's not the case with everyone. In lots of social situations, Grace has to mask in order to survive. Masking is a tool that many autistic people use. Think of it as like being in a constant job interview where you're checking yourself, when to respond, when to smile, how much eye contact to make, am I making too much eye contact? It requires huge and ongoing effort.
The abstract concept of masking is hiding, and often not consciously, hiding or suppressing your needs in order to get through a certain social situation or survive an environment without being punished or shamed.
Yeah. Is it a voice in your head saying, okay, Grace, we're walking to this party, act normal, act normal, act normal? Is that what it is?
I've never had a voice in my head saying act normal, act normal, act normal, because I wouldn't know what normal is. I, like many autistic people, would often have sort of scripts in anticipation of a particular social situation and what I might anticipate was going to happen in that social situation.
Before Grace goes out into the world to socialise, she practices social scripts to try to fit into a neurotypical world.
But it comes from sort of like a conditioned, like deeply ingrained, you know, conditioned awareness of what is socially acceptable, which I think really challenges this common misconception that we hear about autism and autistic people, that we're not empathetic or sensitive to the needs of others. I would argue that in many cases, autistic people are oversensitive, hypersensitive to the needs and feelings and experiences of others because we want to make sure that they're okay and we want to make sure that we're not doing anything that will upset or disturb them.
Masking is also common in ADHD, which Grace has also been diagnosed with. This double diagnosis is called ADHD. The term has only been around since 2013 and sometimes it's hard to know what is autism and what is ADHD.
There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
I think a lot of those symptoms were masked by things that I unknowingly did that that can help manage the symptoms. So I'm a keen runner and cyclist. And when I say keen, I mean extreme. So, you know, I'm going out and I'm running, you know, like sometimes 40 Ks at a time. The races that I train to do a few times a year are 60 Ks and over on foot. Just this morning I cycled 60 Ks. And for me, that's like a sort of a short day on the bike. And that really helps regulate your nervous system. It helps regulate your emotions and it helps take the edge off what can otherwise be sort of pendulous swings of emotion.
Right. So it's like a sort of form of medication.
It's a form of medication. But so I was always sort of doing a lot of activity that was helping to align, sort of like streamline otherwise very chaotic energy.
Mm.
I am an energizer bunny. I'm particularly hard to tire out, even more so if I don't have sort of outlets that I'm regularly engaged in that are healthy.
Yeah. So that was one of your main coping strategies.
Yeah.
Unknowingly.
My brain and my body go a million miles an hour.
Right.
And yeah, like I'm a turbo chicken. Simultaneously a cat and a turbo chicken. I don't know what that would look
and
like.
And an energizer kind of hybrid. Bunny.
Energizer bunny, turbo chicken and a cat.
But being an energizer turbo chicken cat comes at a cost for Grace, emotionally and physically.
I'm really prone to burnout, and because I internalize my needs sort of out of habit, I withstand a lot, and then I get to this sort of like very sudden, seemingly inexplicable breaking point when really it's been a cumulative impact
right.
of things that have been happening over time.
And then what happens?
I just fall in a heap. Sometimes literally, but often it'll be me just sitting and staring into space and essentially catatonic.
For how long?
A couple of days. Mm. And it's interesting, you know, a lot of those sort of like basic life skills and self-care skills like brushing your teeth, having a shower, those fall by the wayside before other things that other people might consider extreme or daunting. It's this sort of this prolonged sensory overload that manifests as a system shutdown. So imagine if you're a computer or a hard drive and you just go whoosh.
This system meltdown isn't necessarily caused by some huge event, say like the Prime Minister calling you difficult or a big media pylon. It can be a build-up of the toll of things like sensory overload and masking and then bam, burnout. After that, Grace needs to lie low for a while, literally.
Recovery might just look like not doing anything that is cognitively difficult, just sort of like quote-unquote vegging out and watching TV. You know, sometimes I just like putting on the L word or something.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, lesbians.
Yeah. And just taking care of yourself mean understanding what is going to dysregulate you and what is going to be one of those accumulative effects like the lights and the buzzing fridge. Is that part of it? Is kind of arranging your environment to
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I like to tidy things because I personally feel as though physical clutter translates to internal clutter.
Mm.
So I like my external world to kind of mimic my interior world or to like set the tone for my interior world.
Yeah.
And then safe foods. Foods that I like eat routinely every day. That's part of my regulation and routine.
Right, same, same. I think I witnessed the first time you tried a lychee.
Yes.
I was like, bitch hasn't tried a lychee?
Not deliberately.
Yeah.
I was not consciously avoiding lychees.
Yeah.
They just didn't factor into my routine.
And does that mean, because I saw you light them, does that mean that's going to be a thing now?
Or? I have now factored it into my routine.
We're talking about coping behaviours and burnout. What were some of your unhealthy coping mechanisms when you were younger?
You may need the legal team for this. they were bleep and bleep and bleep. No. Oh, gosh. I used alcohol as a social lubricant. And certainly after I turned 18, it was any excuse for me to be out drinking because it had an effect of disinhibiting me and sort of relieving, at least temporarily, the anxiety.
To get away from her hometown in Tasmania, Grace moved to the US when she was 18. It was there that her drinking and drug taking escalated.
There were more predators that I encountered that would lure me in with more hard drugs and just sort of spending a lot of time in very unsafe environments that I'm lucky to have survived in hindsight, you know, as an adult woman.
Yeah. Research shows that autistic girls and women face significantly higher rates of sexual violence. You've spoken about how autistic girls can be more vulnerable to grooming. In your experience, what do you feel made you more at risk?
As an autistic person who spent a lifetime suppressing needs in order to survive and trying so desperately to make sure that everyone around me was okay, I suspect that my default to people-pleasing played a large part in being particularly susceptible to grooming and manipulation.
And I want to ask about that too, because a lot of what you've said in the past is about having empathy even for people who are hurting you.
Yeah.
It's wild, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there's I have a tendency to identify or try to find, even in its absence, the humanity in everyone.
Mm.
So I think, you know, that heightened empathy and also the sort of the want to make sure that others are okay made me particularly tolerant of very bad behaviour and, in fact, abusive behaviour.
Do you think you're immune now?
No.
Mm.
No, and it's hard because on the one hand, I've developed a thick skin, but also I think that we need to move through life with a thin skin at the same time, with a gentle skin, to be able to feel.
So, Grace, what do you think autistic girls and women need to be taught early on to help protect them? Or is that putting too much on the victim, potential victim?
I think it is important to equip autistic girls and women with certain safety skills. However, I think it is equally important, if not more important, to educate the non-autistic population on how best to support autistic people. I think the framing should be less around trying to like mold autistic women and girls. It should be less on that and more on opening up the conversation to include better representation of autistic experiences. I always think back on my childhood and I just sort of wish someone had been a bit more blunt with me about the potential of other people to cause harm. Mm. Because I missed that memo.
Yeah, right.
You know, and also that it is okay for you to assert your boundaries. And if someone has a problem with that, that actually doesn't reflect on you, that reflects on them.
Grace has firmer boundaries now about what she does and doesn't want, especially when it comes to intimacy. Grace is queer, and research shows that autistic women are 2 to 3 times more likely to be so. Growing up, there were some signs. Grace remembers liking girls from early on, and when she was about 7 or 8, she refused to wear pink.
I refused to wear girls' clothes, and I made my mum, you know, shop exclusively in the boys' section at department stores.
Mm.
Like, I still have very feminine qualities that I really like, you know, I've got a meter of hair, which is very useful for shoplifting trinkets, you know, and like rehabilitating birds.
When she was living in the States, Grace had a welcome break from the scrutiny that she faced back home.
I was exploring my identity more without the sort of preconceived notions that were projected onto me by others. But yeah, it's taken me up until the last couple of years for me to finally just go, you know, poof.
What's coming off there? Stripper pants?
I don't know. Yeah, chaps. Assless chaps.
Your Velcro tear.
I'm also a gay man, apparently.
cover it all, Grace. Because I do feel like the...
I just never thought, because for me, because I have no judgment of other people's sexuality, orientation, identity, where whatever their skin colour, whatever their like background, you know, poor, rich, whatever. You know, so I'm judging the person on their actions and their intentions. The right. same with autism though as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's only been in sort of like recent years that I've had a public platform and people have asked me, you know, just like specifically about being autistic and the autistic experience, that it's really occurred to me to sort of categorize sorts of things.
Tell me about how you found equality in intimacy with women and what that's allowed you to explore.
Oof. is this the PG or R-rated version? Yeah, certainly, because the sort of the standard was set in an extreme, violent, sadistic way. You know, I lost my virginity via rape on a floor as a 15-year-old to a 58-year-old man who literally laughed. Like, that is very grim. Mm. And I learned as a survival mechanism to go along to get along and to not even know what my sexual sort of desires were. I was just sort of in a position of responding and, you know, making sure that the other person was enjoying themselves. And when I started exploring having intimate relationships with women, it just felt completely different and organic and didn't feel like I needed to be submissive necessarily. I felt like it was more of an exchange, like a dance, you know, as opposed to sort of just being subjected to something.
Yeah, on the receiving end of something.
Yeah, receiving.
Yeah, that sounds like a profound shift.
It was a profound shift.
You've explained your autistic experience as high definition. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
I sort of experience like emotion and senses at the most acute sort of extreme level. Sounds I'm hearing at full volume, colours I'm seeing at their most vivid, senses are like in overdrive.
I really want to ask if it's like being on acid, but I don't want either of us to get cancelled.
I mean, at this point in my career.
Grace has never shied away from standing up for what she believes in, but it does sometimes attract controversy.
Because my sense of injustice is so strong that it overpowers my consciousness of needing to conform.
Yeah.
So I will often take massive risks and pay massive costs.
Okay. Grace, if today's understanding of autism in girls had existed when you were a kid, in what ways do you think your life would have looked different?
Well, I would have been diagnosed much earlier, and I think there would have been more attention put on my specific needs. And I would say hands down that I wouldn't have been sexually abused by a child sex offender.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah, and look, that's nobody's fault except his. I think that my parents did the best they could with what they had to try to protect me. I think that I perhaps also would have been less susceptible to burning out and probably wouldn't have overextended myself as much to fit in.
Grace is just one of many autistic women who have spent years looking for answers and found validation in her diagnosis. She has some advice for other autistic hotties out there.
I want them to know that they are not alone and that as hard as life can be as an autistic woman or an autistic girl, it can be beautiful and joyful and wholesome and regenerative.
This chat has been so lovely and nourishing. Grace frickin' Tame, thank you for being vulnerable and open and sharing your true turbo chicken cat self with us, you frickin' legend.
Oh, from one legend to another. Thank you, Yumi.
Hey, for the next three episodes of Ladies We Need to Talk, I'm going to be handing over the mic duties to you, Grace, to take over boss lady hosting duties as you go deeper on what it's like to be an autistic woman. Can you tell us what's coming up?
We're going to be looking at the science of autism. Mm-hmm. We're going to be looking at why the fuck women and gender diverse people were ignored for so long. and what acceptance looks like when we're all just allowed to be ourselves.
That sounds amazing, but also try not to fuck it up, okay? It's a sacred space. It's a sacred Oh, my God. Can you say it? It's a sacred space, bro. Grace Tame, thank you for being autistic AF.
I don't know how else to be.
This podcast was made on the lands of the Gadigal and Dharawal people. It is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, produced by Emma Morris, and our executive producers are Tamar Cranswick and Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Emma Morris.